This is the Big Shift for Small Farms podcast. G'day listeners, I'm your host Edgars Grestet. You might have heard the saying, from little things, big things grow. Well, in this episode, we're planting some ideas in that paddock between your ears about multi-species pastures. And the benefits are about as diverse as the seed mixes you can sow. From improving soil health with things like compaction, water infiltration and nutrient cycling, to reducing input costs from fertilisers and herbicides, and then to top it off, improving animal health and weight gain efficiency in your livestock. And if you don't take my word for it, we spoke to an agroecologist and a farmer who's recently started experimenting with it. But first, let's meet Adam and Jody, who are about 10 years into their farming journey, using multi-species pastures with their direct-to-consumer beef business, called Spring Hill Beef Co., located at Mount Rivers in the Hunter Valley.
So our vision all along was to get out of our previous business and to be full-time farmers. And being first-gen farmers, we had to really look at the best ways to make money out of the farm.
So we run Angus breeders, we start Angus bulls, and then we finish our Angus weaners for our direct market. We bought Spring Hill in 2016. It was a bare block, and I think we started in drought in 2018. It was one of the worst droughts in memory of any locals. It was probably as bad as they get. Yeah, so when we bought the place, we wanted to improve it. We wanted to have, you know, nice healthy pastures, and we took on the advice of agronomists, and that was basically to spray out paddocks using chemicals, so crops, and then fertilise them with chemical fertilisers. We did that for a couple of years, and then myself and Jody were walking through the paddock one day, and Jody was just kicking the dirt, and she said, "It's grey, it's dead." You know, we started getting into the soil and there was just no life. There was no soil, it was just dirt. And Jody just said, "There's got to be a better way. Like, what are we doing here? How do we build soil and build life in the soil?" So yeah, then we started investigating what other options there were, what sort of practices there were, and started implementing and trialling different things.
One of the practices that Adam and Jody adopted was a transition into multi-species pastures. And they saw a lot of benefits above and below the ground, including healthier cattle and improved soil life.
You dig the soil up now and there's life in it. When we first came here, what we were sowing was like, it was just a Ryan Oats crop, I suppose. It fills that winter feed gap. We've now transitioned into multi-species permanent pastures. We didn't want to be sowing every year. We don't spray, so we no-till drill straight into the paddock that's already there. We use grazing management to graze it down and then sow straight in there. We've got our own seed mix that we've made up, which is untreated seed, and it's generally anywhere from 12 to 18 species of seed to get a lot of diversity in our seed mixes. And then we coat our seed with generally a worm juice and we sow that straight into the soil.
Adam gave us a quick little demo explaining how he coats this multi-species seed mix with the worm juice and some of the benefits that he's seen.
So what we're doing here is we're just coating our multi-species seed mix. Well, this is a worm juice. So what that does is it adds biology to the seed. And also the nutrients it needs to get a good start. So when we first started sowing multi-species pastures, we did trials across all our paddocks. Some were done full conventional, so chemical, synthetic fertilisers. Then some was done fully biologically, so no chemical, no synthetic fertilisers. What we found was while the multi-species pastures that were only done biologically, the crop wasn't probably quite as good as the fully conventional one in the first season, but we didn't get the insect attack. And then every year after that, we've just found better and better results from that biologically treated seed. The other thing we found was to get the same sort of results, we're having to put more and more synthetics on. Whereas with the biological fertilisers, we're finding the opposite. It's longer lasting and we're putting less on over the whole place. So there's a big financial benefit to that as well. So the only thing we could put that down to was it was the biology was working. And that to us again was a trigger that there's something here that works. Let's dig a little deeper and go again. So the next year we sowed the whole place in that way. And then we've found every year it's got better and better.
As well as improving soil health, Adam and Jody have seen benefits to their livestock.
So we've seen our animal health increase since using these practices. Predominantly, we noticed, especially the last couple of years when it was very wet, there was a lot of people having foot problems with their cattle around this area. Local lands were even putting out notifications to keep an eye on your cattle and stuff like that. We had maybe two cattle with 3-day sickness. So we can only put that down again to our practice change.
At the time of recording, Adam and Jody's place was looking pretty dry. But a few weeks later, a little bit of summer rain brought the paddocks back to life, with multi-species bursting out of the ground, which made for some very happy farmers.
We're going into this drought a hell of a lot more confident than we were last time. The message that I would give to other farmers is to keep an open mind and try new things. Put them into practice and see if they work on your landscapes. There's plenty of options, so explore them, try them, keep an open mind.
For us, it suits who we are, our personality, and what we wanted to get out of farming. But if we stop and stand back on what we have achieved in the last 10 years, like, we're really proud of what we've done and happy that our kids are growing up in this environment as well.
Adam and Jody have done a lot to build the resilience of their farm business, and sowing multi-species pastures plays a big role, especially in dry times, because having a diversity of plants has helped them be ready for rain whenever it comes. And as well as the benefits that multi-species bring to grazing animals above the ground, diversity also helps improve soil health and function, which is key to plant growth. Sarah Fee is an agroecologist who coaches farmers about the power of multi-species pastures to improve productivity and the natural environment. And her key message is that every plant plays an important role.
Where there's more species, there's different roles that they're bringing to the landscape in terms of how they not only explore water and nutrients, but also the microbiomes that are associated with them, their supply or support, the whole functioning of the system.
Agriculture has in the past simplified things, and I was thinking multi-species is really just kind of what nature used to be like.
Yes, we've often gone to simplifying it down, thinking that to be easier to manage, but have lost all the value in that complexity. So again, it's all about improving the conditions for supporting the diversity of biology in your system.
Sarah, we heard from Adam and Jody about their journey, the lifelessness in their soils from too many unhealthy inputs, and then trialling something different. What advice do you have for farmers when looking to introduce multi-species pastures?
First of all, getting you out in your pasture and having you look more closely and getting a bit of an overview, a list. You might not necessarily have to know them down to their scientific name or anything like that. You know, getting that appreciation of different species. So who's there now, but also who do you know that shows up, and try and work out what family groups they are in. If you're looking now, say spring, who's there now, but on reflection, who did you see that was there at winter, so that you can get an idea of, yeah, the types of diversity. If you've got grazing animals already on the system, observe them. What are they enjoying eating? What are their grazing habits?
And Sarah says that observation is really important from year to year because, as we know, not all seasons are the same.
We know, depending on the conditions, there's certain species will show up. So you might put certain species in, but right now the conditions aren't right. So they mightn't show up, but you might actually see a season or two seasons down the track, they do show up. It's trying to get aware first, you know, get a good idea of what you've got in terms of plant diversity before you're going to make any changes, what tools you're going to have to bring in, and money and expenditure.
Can you sort of talk us through about what questions should I be asking myself when I'm thinking about the type of multiple species that I want to introduce into my pastures?
I guess there's literature out there that Dr. Christine Jones certainly shares with the community when she's doing her fantastic workshops, that there's some fantastic synergies between having four families and the lift in production that comes from how well they share resources and work together.
A couple of examples of these families include brassicas, grasses, borage, legumes, and the aster family, which includes sunflowers. The key here is that each of these plants belong to different functional groups, and they work together like a community for maximum benefit in the soil microbiome. So, Sarah, how do you choose your families?
When you were looking at the different species and family groups that were already represented, who's well represented and who's lacking, that helps, again, to keep the costs down, complementing what's there. You don't necessarily need to have lots of the same family.
Now what I'm thinking is superheroes, right? You've got those superhero groups and there's each character, the Fantastic Four, right? Like, they all have different qualities that are going to help solve the problem on the day. And you obviously don't want four Iron Men. You need to have a couple of different superheroes.
Well, that's right. And there's the power in them bringing all their different skills together at the end of the day that makes them, yeah, a good team. Depending on what you can see that's missing from the system as well. If ground cover and holding soil surface is really important, then you might bring in species that are low to the ground, like your medics and things like that. And then I guess it's also depending on the time of the year, the amount of moisture available and feed requirements. You know, if you've got really low ground cover currently, then you want to be putting in species that are great at lots of volume in terms of their actual plant structure.
Sarah says that as well as identifying things that you want to improve, it's also important to identify any resource constraints in your landscape when it comes to selecting the right superhero multi-species mix.
Do you have compaction? Therefore bring in deep tap-rooted crops that are going to help work on that compaction layer. Are you actually lacking good nitrogen sources? So that's where you bring in legumes, say. Micronutrients like zinc and things like that, they are limited or that they're more abundant in deeper profiles than things like sunflowers or something like that that can bring nutrients from at depth back to the surface. There is thought that goes into what species do we select. It's just not a case of grabbing a heap of different seeds and flicking it out there. And unfortunately, we're seeing a bit of that happen in some of the seed companies are producing seed mixes and they're not actually supporting a farmer to think about what is my resource constraint. We need to support farmers in thinking about, well, what am I actually trying to achieve here? Have I got a resource issue? Have I got, you know, my carbon nitrogen ratio way out of whack here? Am I really in need of nitrogen? Or in actual fact, am I really in need of more carbon?
So understanding your landscape needs is just as important as the goals you want to achieve when it comes to selecting the right seed mix. Oh, and Sarah says there's one other thing.
And what's my budget? Price is very important in terms of what we're going to invest per hectare. And so therefore what cost of seeds are and availability and what is suitable for your region. And then it's an audit of what tools do you actually have. If we're going to think about bringing in other seed, what equipment do you actually have? Do you have something to spin seed out with? Or is it going to be literally you on a four-wheeler flicking it out? Do you feel like you'll utilise the animals to help move it around the landscape for you? You've got a fantastic neighbour next door that's got lots of toys. Is there a great land care group nearby that's actually got planters that you can hire equipment from? Or is there a bit of a community there, say with a land care group or a farmer group, that you know that there might be that opportunity to strike up these sorts of conversations?
Trying something new has its challenges. Finding other like-minded people, comparing notes and getting insights about what worked and what didn't is all about making the new thing safer and easier to try. One new farmer striking up plenty of conversations is Greg Mumm.
My name is Greg Mumm. We're new to farming. We have three small farms that we do with my father, one in Kangaroo Valley, one in Fitzroy Falls and one in Gunning. And I'm employed as the manager for those three farms.
After a sports career cut short by injury, Greg transitioned from coaching to teaching before finding his true calling in farming, ultimately becoming a full-time farmer in 2021 with his family.
I just love the lifestyle, love being outside. That's partly what I loved about sports coaching, is being hands-on and outside. And yeah, really, I guess, looking at ways which small farmers can be profitable and regenerative at the same time, which has got a few challenges, but also lots of opportunities and synergies.
It sounds like there's been a steep learning curve with your changes in careers over the years. Greg, can you tell me, how did you actually learn to farm?
So I have come through it, like probably a lot of regenerative people, through the YouTube / podcast / book line. So a friend of mine had bought a farm in Robertson where my wife and I actually got engaged, and he put me onto Joel Saladin. So originally I was the multi-species rotational grazing diversity kind of guy, and thought that's all you had to do was have as many different animals as you could, and that's the way you improve the soil and the land. And we tried that here. So at one stage we had cattle, sheep, pigs, chickens. And I realized that was a lot of work for one person without volunteers, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where I got onto other guys like Gabe Brown and some more local people like Colin Sice, who's famous for pasture cropping. And we actually had Colin down here early on in the piece to look at the farm.
One challenge that Greg faces with his coastal pastures is maintaining pasture availability and managing grazing pressure on his landscapes. And it's the advice that he's learnt from Colin and Gabe and others that's helped him develop some of his thinking around multi-species pastures.
Really realised that maybe, one, in terms of working with coastal pastures and the feed gaps that kind of can create, with Kaikuyu particularly, how could we, one, fill those feed gaps with different species, and then two, perhaps that trying to get the diversity in the soil through plants was as good or just as good as trying to do the diversity with animals above ground. We've still got cattle and sheep, so we're really trying to, I guess, simplify everything and work out, well, how can we have the best impact on the land and the business with being efficient with the time? I guess we probably underestimated the amount of learning that goes into agriculture.
In getting started with multi-species, Greg says he took a shotgun approach, asking experts and neighbours in the area for advice.
So we spoke to the local farmers here. The previous tenant who had leased the place for a decade before we bought it. So they hadn't done a lot of cropping, but generally speaking, the dairy guys in the valley go with kind of your ryegrass, clover, maybe some oats mix. And even when I spoke to the agricultural store around here, they went for the same thing. It was like ryegrass and clovers, maybe some oats, perhaps chicory and plantain, and that was the extent of what worked.
Greg decided to be adventurous and sow a more diverse mix to see what showed up.
So we went in with like a 15 species mix and then watched not much come up. So that's really good advice in terms of observation. But one of the challenges we've also got, I guess, is how to get it in. So that's the question, I guess, that I'm trying to work out at the moment. Is it the species or is it the way that it's put into the ground? So some of the neighbours here use herbicide and spray out completely to ensure that they get things up. We're not that philosophy. So it's then, well, how can we get things in? How do we graze properly ahead of it? What tools do we use? We've tried disc seeders with some success, but even the best dairy farmers, like, well, if you get your timing wrong and you get moisture and heat afterwards, the kite can close over that and then you don't get a good strike. So we've taken kind of two approaches there. One is to not spend a lot of time overcomplicating the mixes. So we're actually buying them from Victoria. And we have had some agronomic advice on what we should be putting in. So we have a rough idea of what species we're looking for, but we did get them priced by commercial seed providers. And they came in at 2 to 3 times more expensive than from Victoria. And they had herbicide and pesticide coatings, which is what we were keen to not try. And so we've just said, well, let's just keep it simple with off-the-shelf, cheaper mixes to start, and then we will observe and see what comes up. But then we've put our money into a seeder called a Soil Key Renovator, which was invented in Australia in Gippsland in Victoria by a guy called Niels Olsen, and they were the first farm in Australia to get carbon credits for soil sequestration of carbon. So it's actually a strip tiller, so it tills 17% of every pass. So it's got about an inch till line, then it leaves about a foot of pasture, then an inch till line, and it does that 7 times on each pass. And we spoke to people like Christine Jones about it, who's observed it, and she seems to think that they've just stumbled on the right amount of tillage without disturbing the rest. So yeah, our philosophy's really been off-the-shelf mixes that are cheap so that we're not putting a lot of money into trialing a strip tiller so that we actually till some land and put that seed in. And because we're rookies, that seemed like the lowest risk way of seeding, and then watching what comes up, which is where we're at the moment, is seeing what comes up in our spring perennial mix.
Greg is at the beginning of his journey, but in the few years that he's been on the land, he's already been able to observe
what has worked and what hasn't with direct drilling and broadcasting to help guide him for the future.
So we have kind of trialled those two. I guess the two lessons out of those for us, one was that the direct drilling into existing kaikuyu wasn't a guarantee that you'd get all the species up. So it was a good lesson for us around, well, into established kaikuyu, some things will come up and some won't. So that was a good little lesson out of that. And then the second one was out of necessity in the sense that we'd already bought all the seed and didn't have a seeder, but we trialed that broadcasting and we did get some response, but probably not enough to warrant the time and investment on an ongoing basis in terms of broadcasting into kike. We actually did have a better result with a limited trial of that last year. It's probably just more of the moisture profile this year as well. So they were probably the two tests so far. But yeah, it's exciting because I find myself walking the paddocks most days and seeing what's coming up and seeing if I actually can recognize it or not. It's fun. There's so much to learn. It makes it exciting every day in terms of going out and not quite knowing what you're going to see, along with the normal trials and tribulations of animals.
Greg is still in the early days of his multi-species journey, observing how his soils and livestock are responding to diverse pastures. But if we fast forward, there are measurable benefits for animals grazing on multi-species pastures. Here's Sarah Fee again.
In the grazing situation, we know that having all the different plant species bringing different goodies, and that's bringing that greater diversity of components to the diet. And probably a bit more exciting banquet for your animals. We've got great examples where they're weighing the animals into the paddock and then weighing them as they leave. The gains that those animals are receiving from multi-species far exceeds what they were getting on a single species planted pasture. Huge gains in terms of financial gain, but also efficiency of utilisation of that landscape.
Sarah points out the importance of animals not only benefiting from multi-species, but managed well, they too return the favour by stimulating the plants.
Having the stimulus from the grazing animal themselves and the urine and the dung and whatnot and the saliva even to stimulate all that was going on there, managing them often to keep the system in vegetative state for as long as we can before they run to head so that we've got greater amount of time that they're pumping goodness into the soil and feeding those microbiome, so that herd under the ground as well. And then it's that utilising the animals as a management tool for managing those plants and getting the paddock ready for planting into the next crop.
Sarah says that one indicator of plant health is to look for nodules on their roots. It's important to note that nodules don't exist on all plants, only the nitrogen-fixing legume plants like clovers, vetch and lucerne. These nodules kind of look like warts on a plant, but unlike warts, they're good things to have.
Extra cells have formed. There's sort of been this chaos on the roots that have led to literally structures, lumps being formed around the rhizobium, which are the biology that create this phenomenon inside the roots. And the best way too is to get your shovel and dig up a clump around a plant. Because if you just grab the plant and pull them out, you might actually rip off the nodules and therefore miss seeing them. So it is a lot far more effective to get a good appreciation of what's going on is to actually dig up a nice shovel square full of soil and get the plant itself out and gradually pull away the soil. And sometimes, depending on the soil type, especially your black clays, you might actually want to wash that soil off to get a really good look at it. But otherwise, yeah, looking for these nodules and then carefully, either with pocket knife or if you've got a nice sharp fingernail, breaking those nodules open and you're wanting to see a pinky brown sort of colour inside. And that means that they're actually functional, that the organism is in there happily in symbiotic relationship with the plant creating nitrogen. If you see them white, there has been the trigger, there's been the potential for that formation and for whatever reason it failed and the organism's no longer there. And consider that there's been quite a bit of energy utilised by that plant to actually build that lump. So there's a little bit of opportunity cost in that. And even with the nodulation, remember it is a two-way thing between the organism and the plant, finding that balance between what is required. And sometimes the conditions can come about, especially say when it goes dry and the plant that's reducing its growth because the water is starting to be less available, you might actually see some of these nodules turn green, which has meant that the organism has left the building as such. It's creating like a little factory place for manufacturing nitrogen and creating a home in that nodule.
Nodules are really kind of an indicator that the plant is doing its job. But before you can assess what the nodules are telling you, it's really important to understand your soils, since the effectiveness of nodulation depends on various soil factors like pH, nutrient levels, and the presence of compatible rhizobia strains. Greg told us what he's done to get a better understanding of his soils.
I've done some local land services stuff here through Berry with David Hardwick, did some soil foundation courses. I've done some in Nicole Masters online stuff and then used that to make a little bit better sense of our soil tests and also our soil structure. So I guess when we first bought the farm, we had our soil test, which was given to us. You have this, you don't have that, you need to put this on. But nothing was really spoken about soil structure or soil biology. So one of the big things for me in the last 12 months is understanding that we need to look at all three of those. So physical soil structure, chemical makeup of the soil, and then the microbiology as well. So we're just trying to measure that a little bit. We have done some work with compaction meters here through carbonate. We had a really good program, mentoring program with them, where we did some infield tests, worm counts, dug holes. We've done some slake tests and some structure, those sorts of things, composition tests. So we've done a reasonable amount. What came out a little bit like everyone around here, low calcium. We've actually got really high phosphorus, just doesn't seem to be that plant available. Some paddocks have got high iron levels. And so again, it's probably, we have done some lime work and gypsum, particularly after last year. And so what we're trying to do is really target the paddocks we've been putting the clovers in to put the lime first rather than doing the whole farm, understanding that those clovers will work better in terms of fixing nitrogen once we get the pH up above 5. The other thing we have trialed is different fertilizers. So we've used worm casting pellet and we've tried some foliar sprays with urea and humic acid. And then we've tried a Germinate Plus, which is a regen starter fertilizer down in Young. Some targeted stuff around mainly nitrogen fixing from a chemical point of view. Off the back of advice from David Hardwick and Nicole Masters as well around probably focusing on just getting the diversity of plants first and letting them change the chemical composition through their rhizosome. So probably taking more of a plants first rather than inputs philosophy.
Having shifted his focus to plants and soil health, Greg is seeing opportunities above and beyond his core grazing business.
So that's the idea, is to try to produce outstanding grass-raised beef that's improving the soil and sequestering enough carbon to support a carbon project. Our focus there is really to have something green and growing so that we can be sequestering carbon into the soil 12 months of the year whilst taking the soil forward. And hopefully the carbon project will give us some financial incentive. Obviously it's on small scale farms, not the same as some of the big places out west, but from all indications is 2-3% increase in carbon, even on small farms in the coast, can match what you can make from your livestock. So it's trying to find that sweet spot between production and profitability for small farms, whilst maintaining the focus on regenerating the land and improving the soil quality.
For Greg, experimenting with multi-species pastures is a tool to balance his triple bottom line. But what it's done for him as a land manager more broadly is prove that opportunities show up in life when we open our minds to change and doing something different. The Big Shift podcast is proudly produced by Grow Love Project in partnership with Greater Sydney Local Land Services. Thanks to all our guests who've generously shared their time and their stories. To find out more about the opportunities they've talked about, we've provided some links in the show notes. And remember, if you like what you heard, please share it. Thanks for listening.